Underworld, Disc 15.
The train was one of his, Moon Man's. He had a dozen pieces running through the system, top to bottom burners. And it just so happens he was aboard tonight, under the water mains and waste pipes, under the gas and steam and electric, between the storm sewers and telephone lines. And he moved from car to car with each stop and checked out the people who stepped inside, wearing their retractable subway faces. And the doors went ding-dong before banging shut. Ismael Munoz, dark and somber, watching people come aboard. Sparsely stubbled Ismael, reading lips and faces, hoping he might catch a bravo comment. Hey, this guy is lighting up the line. This was his newest piece, so here he was going uptown on the Washington Heights local, every car tagged with his own neon zoom, with highlights and overlapping letters and 3D effect. The whole wild-style thing of making your name and street number a kind of alphabet city, where the colors lock and bleed, and the letters connect, and it's all live jive. It jumps and shouts. Even the drips are intentional, painted super sharp to express how the letters sweat, how they live and breathe and eat and sleep. They dance and play the sax. This was not a window-down piece. This was a whole train burner, with windows painted over, and each letter and number bigger than a man. Moonman 157. Ismael was 16, not too old and not too young, and he was determined to kill the shit of every subway artist in town. Nobody could take him down. And he sat there in his khaki jacket with his eyes ever moving, waiting for someone to say something that would make his day. He knew he was getting fame. He had imitators now, a couple of fairy-ass kids who tried to out-king him in his own country. One of them got busted by the Vandal Squad, sentenced to clean graffiti from the station walls with an orange juice mixture, because there's an acid in the juice that eats into paint. Serves a chulo right for biting my style. And he sat there with his longish face and misaligned teeth, an old man's worried head. And he studied the platform people at every stop. They reacted to the train. Their heads went, wow. Some shocked looks, too. They're seeing hell on wheels. But mostly, the eyes go, yes, and the faces open up. And he studied the riders as they shuffled in, carrying umbrellas, some of them, and concealed weapons, others, and gum wrappers, and phone numbers, and crushed Kleenex, and hankies wrapped around house keys, all wadded together on their mulatto bodies, because the subway's where the races mix. It made him think he was an unknown hero of the line, riding a train he'd maximum tagged, revealing himself in a cartoon glow. Hey, it's Moon Man in our midst. Once a man stood on the platform and took a picture of one of Moon Man's top-to-bottoms, a foreigner by the look of him. And Ismael sidled to the open door so he could be in the picture too, unknown to the man. The man was photographing the piece and the writer both, completely unknown to himself, from some place like Sweden, he looked. The whole point of Moon Man's tag was how the letters and numbers told a story of backstreet life. At Columbus Circle, he changed to the Broadway train because he had business at the end of the line. He got on a train that was bombed inside and out by Skatey 8, a 13-year-old rider who frantically tagged police cars, hearses, garbage trucks, who took his Krylon satin colors into the tunnels and tagged up the walls and catwalks. He hit platforms, steps, turnstiles, and benches. He'd tag your little sister if she's walking by. Not a style king, no way, but a legend among writers for the energy he put forth, getting his tag seen by major millions. And then, 2 weeks ago, and a genuine regret went through Ismael as he recalled being told. He slumped and sagged all over again, and felt the deepest kind of soldierly sadness. Skatey 8 hit by a train while he's walking on the tracks under downtown Brooklyn. People moved along the car. They skated to a seat. They looked at display ads above the heads across the aisle, all without eye motion that you could detect with the most delicate device. Ishmael used to walk the tracks when he felt sorry for himself. Those were foregone times. He'd pop an emergency hatch on the sidewalk and climb down into a tunnel and just, like, go for a walk. Be alone down there, keeping the third rail in sight and listening for the train, and getting to know the people who lived in the cable rooms and up on the catwalks. And that's where he saw a spray paint scrawl, maybe 5 years ago, down under 8th Avenue. Bird lives. It made him wonder about graffiti, about who took the trouble and risk to walk down this tunnel and throw a piece across the wall. And how many years have gone by since then? And who is Bird? And why does he live? And the guy who reached around, saying, "Excuse me, please." He rode up the edge of Manhattan, headed for the Bronx. There was no art in bombing platforms and walls. You have to tag the trains. The trains come roaring down the rat alleys, all alike, and then you hit a train, and it's yours, seen everywhere in the system. And you get inside people's heads and vandalize their eyeballs. The doors went ding-dong before banging shut. He saw a thin black male standing at the end of the car, disregardful. He's acting out the birth of the cool. And Ishmael thought he was an undercover cop. It made him go low profile in his mental makeup, willing himself to be unnoticed in his seat, because he believed they were closing in on him. There was a big push out of City Hall to wipe out graffiti once and for all, to cork these ghetto crews and the middle-class white boys that came biting in behind them. And riders were being careful and playing safe. He didn't fear arrest, only the complications that would follow. Arrest would be good for his notoriety. It might even mean a story in the Post. But then the matter of the family begins to be important. It's not that he didn't want to be a father. He liked the idea of father and family. But there were so many things in between. When he walked the tunnels as a kid, he used to ask about Bird, and he found out this was Charlie Parker, a jazz giant. He used to talk to the men who lived on the catwalks and in the unused freight tunnel under the west side. They had beds and chairs and shopping carts. They had slippers they put on in the evening. They were mostly ordinary men. They washed the dishes and took out the garbage. And they told him about Bop, Bebop, and how Bird was dead at 34. And one day, Ishmael, maybe he's 13, he's taken a leak against a wall, and a guy comes along and stands behind him and reaches around, believe it or not, saying, "Excuse me," and holds Ishmael's dick while he pisses. Dead at 34, that was Bird, which was a ripe old age in the tunnels. He knew he was getting fame because he had imitators first, and because other writers didn't disrespect him by spraying over his work, except some of them did, and because two women came looking for him in the Bronx. But see, this was the way his mind was reasoning at this particular time. Stay totally low and out of sight. Do not get your name or face in the papers. Do not get in trouble with the transit police. Because he had a woman he used to live with who was pregnant head to toe. They used to live with her mother and her mother's part-time man. And it isn't that Ishmael Munoz doesn't want to be a father. It's just that this is not the time to get personally involved. He heard they went into the Superettes, two women from the galleries. They went into the bodegas, the church, the firehouse. He pictured them going into the firehouse to ask about graffiti. 20 men in rubber boots eating combination pizzas. He sat on the Broadway train listening to the way his mind was reasoning. People from the galleries were all over the Bronx looking for Moon Man, for Momzo Tops, for Snack Bar and Rhymester and the whole voodoo crew. Forget it, man. He could easily envision a case where the whole gallery scene is a scam by the police to get writers out of the tunnels and train yards and into the open, identified by name and face. The man held his dick, and eventually sucked it. Whenever it was, a couple of days later, or weeks, that was the act he performed. And Ismail went down there, feeling sorry for himself, fairly often after that. Going through a fence near the West Side Highway, and into an opening in a grated emergency exit, and down the narrow steps into the freight tunnel, where they had bookshelves, some of them, and Christmas decorations, and used half-names and code names, tags like the writers would develop. And the truth of the matter is that he still goes down there for sex with men, because some habits you drop and others you come to rely on. The train went past City College, then veered east. They did it herky-jerky in the dark. Or they went to a cable room and did it with sheets and towels. They kept pets down there, and ran clotheslines across the tunnel, and stole electricity from the government. Bop, bebop, and how Bird was dead at 34. And he sat there in his khaki slouch, looking down between his feet, glancing at the feet across the aisle, all the notched and dimpled shoes that did not seem to be things that people bought and wore, so much as permanent parts, body parts, inseparable from the men and women sitting there, because the subway seals you durably in the stone of the moment. The train entered the Bronx, and he got off four stops later, at the end of the line, where his crew was waiting faithfully. There were three of them, ages 12, 11, and 12, and they'd spent the day racking paint from hardware stores, which is a pastime, petty theft, that Ismail has long since risen above. They walked up the steep hill at 242nd Street. "Where's the rain?" Ismail said. "Nothing happened," they said. "I hear rain already all day. I figure we don't work tonight. 10-1 against." "Nothing happened," they said. "2-3 drops." They had the spray paint cans in three gym bags. They had Ismail's sketches in a manila portfolio. They had peaches and grapes in a paper bag inside a plastic bag. They had the French mineral water he liked to drink while he worked, also acquired in the day's little wave of thievery. Perrier, in pretty green bottles. He believed in going elite whenever possible. They had nozzles for the spray cans. They had master keys to open up the cars in case he wanted to work inside, which he did not. His crew consisted of hopefuls, of course, upriders of the future. They racked for the master. They kept lookout while he painted. They cross-braced their arms to support his weight when he needed to reach the upper part of a car. A chain-link fence ran along the street, topped by razor ribbon. The crew paused near the west end of the fence, where there was a section of snipped links, concealed by poison ivy. They held back the fence, and Ismail edged through, jump-stepping to the roof that was adjacent. There was a series of equipment sheds with sawtooth roofs. They went to the last roof and shinnied down drain pipes to the wooden planking at track level, which they could do in their sleep by now, and began to look around for a suitable train to tag. They knew pretty much in advance that they wouldn't be hassled. There were too many trains, too many riders. The city couldn't afford all the guards that would be needed to patrol the yards and sidings through the night. They saw Rhymester near a light tower, one of the older writers, a black guy wearing a kufi, a skullcap, who did amazing wild-style window downs, Ismail had to admit, the letters decorated with love poems and sentiments of heartbreak. They gave each other ceremonial respect, with precise and detailed flourishes of handshake and phraseology, and they rapped about this and that. And then Rhymester described how he'd seen six of his cars going under the acid bath in the large yard about a mile and a half south of here. They run the cars under sprinklers built above the track. All his 2 in the morning spray-crazy unpaid labor getting buffed away in minutes. Forget orange juice, man. This was the new graffiti killer. Some weird shit chemical from the CIA. It's like you knock a picture off a shelf and someone dies. Only this time it's you that's in the photo. That's how some writers felt about their tags. There were a dozen tracks at the siding here. Ismael and his crew went to the far end, to the last track, overlooking the field where the Irish played Irish football. They picked out a flat. This was an old train with a paintable surface, much better than the ridges that were coming on the market. The crew lined up his colors and he went to work. He had a Rust-Oleum yellow he'd started using, like Mad Canary. And the crew fitted different nozzles on the can so he could vary the breadth and mass of the strokes. "We've seen Lourdes," they said to him. Lourdes was the woman he used to live with, 2 years older than Ismael, more or less, and maybe 20 pounds heavier right now.
"Who asked you who you seen?"
"She say you she want to talk to you."
"Maracón, who asked? I ask?"
Ismael rarely got angry. He wasn't an angry guy. He had the reflective head of an elder of the barrio, playing dominoes under a canopy while the fire engines idle up the street. But if the crew expected to do the fill-in once he set the style and faded the colors, they better learn the manners of the yard.
"Where's my Perrier, okay? You want to work with Ismael Munoz, you give him his Perrier, and forget about messages from whoever."
They worked through the night without unnecessary talk. They handed him the spray cans. They shook the cans before handing them over, and the clicking sound of the aerosol ball was basically the only noise in the yard except for the spray itself, the hissy wash of paint folding over the old iron flanks of the train. The man who reached around and said, "Excuse me." "Moon Man 157. Add the digits and you get 13. But that's the street where he lives, or used to live. He lives a lot of places now, so it's properly part of his tag. It's what they know him as. And bad luck is an ego trip you can count on. And think of a train coming out of the tunnels and going elevated. Think of your tag in maximum daylight rolling over the scorched lots where you were born and raised." The crew shook the cans and the ball went click. He stood on the door edge of one train and leaned across to the train parked adjacent and tagged it from the windows up. And he went down the slate stairway that crumbled to the pressure of his weight, his hand on the rusty pipe that was the banister. And he felt the mood of the tunnel on a given day. It might be a coke mood one day. Ismael did not do drugs. Or a mood of speed that's traveling through the tunnel. Someone made a buy and shared it. Or a mood of mental illness, which was often the case. And always a brown rat mood. Because they were there in pack rat numbers. An endless source of stories. The size of the rats. The attitude of unfearing. How they ate the bodies of those who died in the tunnels. How they were eaten in turn by the rat man who lived in level 6 under Grand Central. He killed and cooked and ate a rat a week. Track rabbits, they were called. In other words, to muralize a whole train, you need a full night and part of the next night and no shuffling bullshit talk. And a mood of who you are in your head day by day, which he didn't share with anyone at street level. And going to sleep in a cousin's bed at night, or in the supply cellar of some bodega where they knew Ismael Munoz and gave him a place that was adequate. And hearing the doors go ding-dong, and seeing the man from Stockholm, Sweden, who took pictures of his piece. He liked to watch the eyes of platform people to see how they reacted to his work. His letters and numbers told a story of tenement life, good and bad, but mostly good. The verticals in the letter N could be drug dealers guarding a long diagonal stash of glassine product, or they could be schoolgirls on a playground slide, or a couple of sandlot ballplayers with a bat angled between them. Nobody could take him down. He kinged every artist in town. They had dozens of cans out and ready, all by prearrangement. And he called a color, and they shook the can, and the ball went click. "Where's my Perrier?" he said. But you have to stand on a platform and see it coming, or you can't know the feeling a writer gets. How the number 5 train comes roaring down the rat alleys and slams out of the tunnel, going whop-pop onto the high tracks, and suddenly there it is, Moon Man riding the sky in the heart of the Bronx over the whole burnt and rusted country. And this is the art of the back streets talking, all the way from Bird, and you can't not see us anymore. You can't not know who we are. We got total notoriety now. Momzo Tops and Rhymester and me. We're getting fame. We ain't ashamed. And the train go rattling over the garbagey streets and past the dead-eye windows of all those empty tenements that have people living there even if you don't see them. But you have to see our tags and cartoon figures and bright and rhyming poems. This is the art that can't stand still. It climbs across your eyeballs night and day. The flickery jumping art of the slums and dumpsters, flashing those colors in your face. Like I'm your movie, motherfucker. They came funneling out of the lobby and moved down the aisles and found their seats. The anticipation of early evening largely depleted by now. And they settled in quickly, all business, and the second half of the film began. Clara looked around for Miles, but Miles didn't show. He'd evidently sensed the impatience of his guests and decided to stay with the cineasts in the private booth upstairs.
"Does this mean we're unworthy?" Esther said.
"It seems you are witnessing an escape. Figures moving upward through gouged tunnels into a dark, rainy night. A long scene of silhouettes and occasional tight shots, eyes peering in the dark. Then a spotlight swung across the orchestra pit and came to rest on a side curtain on the north wall, set slightly higher than the stage and some yards distant. And you knew what you were going to see a half second before you saw it, and what a mood booster, absolutely. The curtains parted, and the horseshoe console of New York's last great theater organ, the mighty Wurlitzer, stood framed and gleaming in the dark hall. The organist was a slightish man, white-haired, who seemed to hover in the alcove, his back to the audience, wizardly in his very smallness. And he hit the thunder pedal just as a figure on the screen drew back, cowering from some danger above, and laughter swept the auditorium. The prisoners continued their climb, moving in grim proximity to each other. The organist hit a series of notes that had an uncanny familiarity, the sort of thing that takes you hauntingly back to your bedside radio and the smells in your kitchen, and the way the linoleum used to ripple near the icebox. It was a march, sprightly is the word, and it worked in ironic counterpoint to the foreground silhouettes on the screen, figures climbing in rote compliance. And Clara felt the music in her skin and could practically taste it on her tongue, but wasn't able to name the piece or identify the composer. She gave old Jack a poke in the arm. "What's he playing?"
"Prokofiev."
"Prokofiev, of course. Prokofiev did scores for Eisenstein. I knew that. But what's this march?"
"It's that Three Oranges thing, whatever it's called. You've heard it 1,000 times.
"Of course, yes. But why have I heard it 1,000 times?
"Because it was the theme music in an old radio show, brought to you by Lava Soap. Remember Lava Soap?"
"Yes, yes, of course."
And Jack chanted in sacramental sync with the organ. "L-A-V-A, L-A-V-A."
"Of course, yes. It's completely clear to me now. But I don't remember the program," she said.
And Jack kept chanting because he was having such a good time with this. And so was the audience, eyes shifting from the screen to the console and minds locked in radio recall. Those of you who were old enough. And somewhere backstage, in 12 lofts,
The enormous organ pipes sounded the tones. Pipes, wind chests, shutters, and blowers, bringing this vintage theme, borrowed from a Russian opera, back home to the past. And Jack left off his chanting to adopt the bardic voice of a veteran announcer doing the show's opening. "The FBI in peace and war," he spoke ringingly. It was nice to have friends. Clara remembered now. Neighbor kids used to listen to the show faithfully toward the end of the war, and she could almost hear the voice of the actor who played the FBI field agent. The curtain closed on the organist just as the sun came out, and Esther said, "Finally!" Yes, the film has climbed to the surface, to a landscape shocked by light, pervasive and overexposed. The escaped prisoners move across flat terrain, some of them hooded, the most disfigured ones, and there are fires in the distance. The horizon line throbbing in smoke and ash. You wonder if he shot these scenes in Mexico, or could it be Kazakhstan, where he went to shoot Ivan the Terrible later during the war? Many long shots, sky and plain, intercut with foreground figures, their heads and torsos crowding out the landscape, precisely the kind of formalist excess that got the director in trouble with the apparat. The orchestra was in its covert mode, somewhere under the pit, playing faintly at first, a soft accent edged against the strong visuals. You study the faces of the victims as they take off their hoods. A cyclops, a man with skewed jaw, a lizard man, a woman with a flap of skin for a nose and mouth. A series of eloquent largo passages begins to fill the hall. The audience was stilled. You saw things differently now. If there was a politics of montage, it was more intimate here. Not the themes of atomic radiation or irresponsible science, and not state terror either. The independent artist who is disciplined and Sovietized. These deformed faces, these were people who existed outside nationality and strict historical context. Eisenstein's method of immediate characterization, called typage, seemed self-parodied and shattered here, intentionally. Because the external features of the men and women didn't tell you anything about class or social mission. They were people persecuted and altered. This was their typology. They were an inconvenient secret of the society around them. Now there is a search party on the prowl, men on horseback strung out across the plain. They recapture some of the fugitives. They shackle and march them in somber lockstep, in tired, mindless versions of the stage routines. And Clara saw it retrospectively, how the Rockettes had prefigured this. Only it wasn't funny anymore. And they bare the faces of those who are still hooded, and the shots begin to engage a rhythm, long shot and close-up, landscape and face, waves of hypnotic repetition, and the music describes a kind of destiny, a brutish fate that bass drums down the decades. Clara was moved by the beauty and harshness of the scenes. You could feel a sense of character emerge from each rough unhooding, a life inside the eyes, a textured set of experiences, and an understanding seemed to travel through the audience, conveyed row by row in that mysterious telemetry of crowds. Or maybe not so mysterious. This is a film about us and them, isn't it? They can say who they are, you have to lie. They control the language, you have to improvise and dissemble. They establish the limits of your existence. And the camp elements of the program, the choreography and some of the music, now tended to resemble sneak attacks on the dominant culture. You try to imagine Eisenstein in the underground of bisexual Berlin, 45 years ago, with his domed head and somewhat stunted limbs, hair springing from his scalp in clownish tufts, a man with bourgeois scruples and a gift for sublimation. And here he is in the Kit Kat, or the Bow Wow, seamy, heated cellars, unthinkable in Moscow, and he's dishing Hollywood gossip with men in drag. "I'm terribly fond of Judy Garland. he once said. But you don't want to be too modishly knowing, do you? He was a dynamo of ideas and ambitious projects, but it isn't clear that he had the sexual resolve to realize actual contact with either men or women. Look at the figures in long shot on the low, smoky line of the plane. All Eisenstein wants you to see, in the end, are the contradictions of being. You look at the faces on the screen, and you see the mutilated yearning, the inner divisions of people and systems, and how forces will clash and fasten, compelling the swerve from evenness that marks a thing lastingly. You realize the orchestra has been silent for a time. All hoods removed, members of the expedition plodding in endless matching step, trailed by distempered dogs oozing from the eyes. Then you hear the melody again, one more time, the familiar march from Prokofiev. Not the mock heroic organ, but a full orchestra now, and the pitch is very different. Forget the amusing radio reminiscence. It is all vigilance and suppression. The FBI in peace and war and day and night, your own white-collar cohort of the law. The march lasted only a minute and a half, but how dark and strong. What fatedness in the rolling brass. And then there was a long silence and a white screen, and finally a face that transfigures itself in a series of multiple exposure shots, losing its goiters and gnarls. A seamed eye reopening. And it was awfully mawkish, okay, but wonderful also. A sequence that occurred outside the action proper. A distinct and visible wish connecting you directly to the mind of the film. And the man sheds his marks and scars and seems to grow younger and paler until the face finally dissolves into landscape. The orchestra began to rise into the pit, and the music now was Shostakovich. You're sure of this, how spacious and skysome, lyrically wheeling, bird-wheeling over the wide plain. Then it ended. It didn't end, it just stopped dead. A landscape of foreground dogs and distant figures leaning to their march. Clara remained in her seat. You all did. And she felt a curious loss. That thing you used to feel as a child when you walked out of a movie house in the middle of the day, and the streets were all agitation and nasty glare, every surface intense and jarring, people in loud clothing that didn't fit. Miles showed up, and they went to a bar that Jack knew. Jack knew all the Midtown bars. He knew the steakhouses and the best cheesecake, and where you got onion soup that makes you think you're in La Halle. And he told funny stories about his early days in the theater district, flacking shows up and down the street. But Clara wasn't listening. The film was printed on her mind in jits and weaves. She felt she was wearing the film instead of a skirt and blouse. She heard Esther laugh, and it sounded like someone in a room three rooms away. Miles told a story that required her to join in, but she couldn't get the details straight. She smiled and drank her wine. The conversation was over there somewhere. She kept seeing snatched fragments. She saw the marked faces in the great landscape. She had the movie all around her, sitting in a bar under walls of white neon, beating in the Broadway heat. Chapter 4. In cities, you build a language of circumspection and tact, a thousand little intimations, the nuance that has a shimmer of rubbed bronze. Then you go to the wilderness and become undone, lapsing into babble, eating mushroom caps that implode your brain, that make you preternaturally aware and afraid, turn you into an Aztec bird. Matt Shea sat in the terminal at the airport in Tucson and listened to announcements bouncing off the walls. He was thinking about his paranoid episode at the bombhead party the night before. He felt he'd glimpsed some horrific system of connections in which you can't tell the difference between one thing and another, between a soup can and a car bomb, because they're made by the same people in the same way and ultimately refer to the same thing. There was a garbage strike in New York. There was a man being paged known only as Jack. A woman with an accent said to someone seated next to her, "I so-called fell in love with him the day he paint my walls." There was a man in a wheelchair eating a burrito. He sat waiting for Janet's plane to be announced. He wondered if this might be a good time to call his brother. Nick was living in Phoenix now, doing some vague consulting work and teaching Latin once a week at a junior college. When Nick dies, a team of metaphysicians will examine the black box, the personal flight recorder that's designed to tell them how his mind worked, and why he did what he did, and what he thought about it all. But there's no guarantee they'll find the slightest clue. Reciting Latin epigrams to business majors in a place called Paradise Valley. Matt took off his glasses and blew on the lenses. His mouth worked into a whispery ellipse, and then he ran his handkerchief over the steamy surface and held the glasses to the light. Whenever the ambient voice asked someone to pick up the white courtesy phone, a small girl made a fist and spoke into it. He put his glasses on. Janet came out of the gate, and he laughed when he saw her. Laughed in sheer and healthy delight, in relief that she was finally here, and in physical anticipation as well. And he laughed at the shambles they were going to make of the camping trip they were taking. And he laughed in the end because he couldn't help it. He was woozy from the long day's drive and didn't have the strength to keep from laughing. Janet walked briskly toward him, wearing a slightly twisted grin, the one that meant she wasn't completely sure what she was doing here. "The captain said it's 104. Should I call Nick?" "What for?" "It was 72 in Boston." "He's right up the road. It seems dumb not to call." "There's a garbage strike in New York," she said. He was woozy from driving, and she was numbed by confinement and engine noise. They went to the parking area and crammed her bags into the Jeep. The Jeep was brimful, a consumer cartoon bulging with equipment, clothing, luggage, and books. "Tell me again where we're going," she said. They spent the night at the edge of an Indian reservation, in an old adobe lodge with a teenage girl eating popcorn at the desk and the white dome of an observatory visible from their bed. It was a fine beamed room with creepy suburban furniture, and they were shy because they hadn't seen or touched each other in a long time, and Janet had to get used to this. They'd only slept together several times, planned always in advance. They didn't have a set of understandings, a pace and glance, the whole hushed protocol of wishes and hints, bodies lightly brushing in the elevator. There was no elevator here. And Janet was a little unsure of herself in a strange room. It wasn't really her, was it? Another woman might feel the lure of anonymity, meeting a man in a room of 1,000 previous men and women, shedding the personal past in a faceless sort of motel abandon. But this wasn't a motel, and at least there was that to be thankful for. She was nervous, standing by the window in her jeans and bra. They'd gotten only as far as the bra. That's when she paused to talk, to let him know how she felt. She wasn't sexually anxious. She was sexually anxious, yes, but mainly unsure in a general way, she said, because it didn't seem completely comfortable, meeting a man in a setting that had predetermined expectations, a strange bed in the middle of nowhere. She had a way of seeing herself, a wariness about things that didn't feel right. The place wasn't particularly clean, for one thing. The girl downstairs, for another, cross-eyed or wall-eyed, whatever. She talked to him honestly, in her small voice, slightly piping, and he lay in bed and listened, waiting for her to get used to the idea. A flight across country that ends in a random sort of room, making her feel isolated from everything that's familiar. He listened and waited, and finally understood that some of the things she was saying about herself were also true of him. He understood this the way you sneak up on things you've always sort of known. She stood by the window. Over her shoulder he could see the observatory dome washed in last light at the top of the mountain. There were men who walked these deserts 100 years ago, the penitentes, chanting and fasting, scourging themselves with hemp whips, or whips made from the braided fiber of the yucca plant, or cord whips, la cuerda, a small whip of tightly knotted wool. Janet didn't know how to look at the desert. She seemed to resent it in some obscure, personal way. It was too big, too empty. It had the audacity to be real. They drove and talked. "Tell me again why we're going there?" "It's a wildlife preserve and gunnery range. So if one doesn't kill us, the other will." He reached over and put his hand on her leg. "We want to be alone," he said.
"We could be alone in Boston."
"They don't have bighorn sheep there. We want to see bighorns in the wild."
"What will we do when we see them?"
"We'll be happy. It's rare that anyone sees them. And it's very remote where we're going. We'll rejoice and be glad. They're beautiful animals that no one ever sees." She moved closer to him. She didn't like public affection, and even if they were alone on the road, it wasn't her apartment, was it? And it wasn't even a room in a lodge with a locked door and drawn curtains, once she'd gotten around to drawing the curtains. But she moved a little closer anyway, and told him if she'd known he was going to stroke her thigh, she wouldn't have worn thick, coarse jeans, would she? Matt didn't think he'd ever felt so happy. He was happy when she leaned against him, and maybe happier still when she read aloud from the small library he'd amassed in preparation for the trip. They saw hawks installed on utility poles, and she looked them up in the bird book and said they were kestrels, falcons, not hawks, and this made him happier yet. The landscape made him happy. It was a challenge to his lifelong cityness, but more than that, a realization of some half-dreamed vision, the otherness of the West, the strange great thing that was all mixed in with nation and spaciousness, with bravery and history, and who you are and what you believe, and what movies you saw growing up. After a while, he told her to stop looking at the book and look at the scenery, but the scenery was empty spaces and lonely roads. And this made her very nervous. When Nick came back from Minnesota, Matty called him the Jesuit. His catechism days were well behind him now, Matty's were, his days of blind belief. And he liked to jibe at his brother's self-conscious correctness, his attempts at analytical insight. Whatever Nick's experience in correction, and however deftly the Jebbies worked him over later in their northern fastness, minting intellect and shiny soul, it was still a brother's right to heckle and jeer. Their mother also called him the Jesuit, but never so Nick could hear. They filled the tank and bought charcoal, food, and bottled water. They found the office of the refuge manager at the far end of town, and Matt went in and received a permit and signed a liability release. This was called a hold harmless form, and it basically pointed out that if they were killed and or injured during live fire exercises while they were in the refuge, it would be the giddiest sort of childlike illusion for either or both of them and or their survivors to think for even a minute about receiving compensation. Fair enough. They were allowed to enter the refuge, but placed on notice that air-to-air exercises were set to commence 3 days from now. Friendly fire. It put a little edge in their schedule. He told all this to Janet conscientiously. He told her they weren't allowed to handle or take possession of any military items found in the area, such as fuel drums, flare casings, tow targets, projectiles carrying real or dummy warheads. He told her there were no human inhabitants of the refuge. He told her there was no gas, food, lodging, or other facilities. She had a right to know. He told her there were no paved roads or running water. But he didn't tell her why this excited him. He didn't say anything about this because he didn't understand it. The stark sort of shudder, the leveling out, the sense of knowing he was headed into remote Sonoran waste, where the interplay of terrain and weapons was a kind of neural process remapped in the world. A hollow sort of craving lifted out of the brainstem, or wherever, and painted over with words and sky and diamondback desert. Janet said, "All right, go, 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 go. That's the spirit. We're going to do it. Let's do it. That's what I want to hear." They drove south through a white space on the map, headed for the entrance to the refuge, and he recalled something Eric Deming had told him about this part of Arizona. A rumor, a sort of Twilight Zone story about people known as sensitives, men and women who were psychically gifted, telepathists, clairvoyants, metal benders. There was a secret facility near the Mexican border where sensitives were tested and experiments carried out. The idea was that psychic commandos might be able to jam the enemy's computer networks and weapon systems, perhaps even read the intentions of the defense minister riding in his chauffeured car in the middle of Moscow. "In fact, the Russians were thought to be well ahead of us in this endeavor," Eric said, "soulful and mystical as they were, and we were desperate to catch up." Janet said, "There's something else, of course."
"What do you mean?"
"Besides sheep. We're not going all this distance to look at sheep."
"Bighorn sheep. We want to be alone, undistracted, so we can talk. An extended period, so we can figure things out."
"What things?"
"You know what things."
"What things?"
"Do we get married? Do we have kids, children? Do we wait a while? Do we live here, or there, or somewhere in the middle?"
"What else?" she said. "Because I know there's something else." Matt could believe the story about a closed base where sensitives refined their paranormal skills. Thought transfer and remote viewing. Why not believe it? He'd read many an enemy's mind as a 10-year-old, pushing wood across a game board. This was the supernatural underside of the arms race, miracles and visions. The final wishful weapon is a middle-aged lady from Decatur who can pinpoint the location of Soviet submarines off the East Coast. Unreal. This is what disturbed him. It was one of the things he wanted to talk about with Janet. There were ship ridges, great ship rocks with prows thrust upward. And there were hills that resembled rubble heaps. The land seemed to be an open formation, harsh and scarred, and you could almost read upheaval and convergence. It looked like dinosaur country. They saw white mountains and flesh mountains and slags of glassy matter that turned out to be mountains when they drew near. It took a long time to get anywhere. There was only one road, one track, and sections were deep sand and other parts were ruts and gullies. The sun beat down with a swarming sort of density. They came to flooded stretches, where they had to leave the track and maneuver the jeep tenderly around the Palo Verde and Chola. He looked up the words. He consulted the books all the time. He drove with a book or two in his lap, or asked Janet to look things up, or asked her to drive so he could read. The dust powdered the hood and windshield, and the sun seemed nearly upon them, burning down so squarely and vastly, he wanted to laugh in shit-faced fear. I know you can't tell me about your job.
I can tell you some things. I work with safing mechanisms, they're called. Timers, batteries, switches, actuators, electromechanical locks. I run endless computer tests. I drink instant coffee and look at cross-section details of great finned weapons on my screen. Then a bunch of guys in California or Nevada or someplace will take a warhead and rocket launch it into a hardened target at 1,500 miles an hour. To test your calculations. Splat. Not just mine, of course, but yes, that's the idea. You make weapons safer. Safer to handle and use.
That's right.
Then what's the problem? It's not exactly criminal activity.
No, but it's weapons work. It's what I wanted. I wanted this and more, but now I'm feeling unsure about it.
It's important work, Matthew. We need the best people to do this work.
They were camped just yards from the track. He made a charcoal fire and they emptied cans of pork and beans into a pan. They put on sweaters and sat on a blanket. She said, "What would you do if you left?"
"I'm not sure.
Get a doctorate, maybe? I know some people who work in think tanks. I want to talk to them, sound them out." She gave him a sour look. The term made her unhappy. Think tank. And he didn't blame her. Passive, mild, middle-aged, ivory towerish. People rustling papers and redoubts of social strategy. Situation reports, policy alternatives, statistical surveys. He got the flashlight and led her to a spot where she might pee. The moon was nearly full. He waited while she lowered her jeans and squatted, more or less in one motion. And she looked at him and smiled, a dirty sort of smirk, a dirty-faced girl with mucky drawers. "Didn't we do this once before, in another life?" He played the light around them and softly sang the names of bushes and shrubs to the sound of Janet piddling. She laughed and peed in spurts. They thought they heard a coyote, and she struggled into her jeans, laughing. They set up the dome tent and got into their mummy-shaped camp bags, nicely lined with flannel. And they realized the coyote was Wolfman Jack on the transistor radio, a howling disc jockey vectored into the desert from some bandit station below the border.
"Don't put no bad mouth on me, baby. We're going to rock tonight. The Wolfman sending Little Richard to climb in your face from out of the glory days of the Marcel Pompadour and the glass suit. Richard don't need no dryer cleaner. He got his Windex with him."
The sleeping bag had stretch straps that made it possible for you to roll over on your side, if that was your preference. And when Little Richard started bending notes in his primal falsetto, Matty thought he was in bed in the Bronx, a 15-year-old capable of trading his brother's old fielder's glove for 3 or 4 raunchy rock-and-roll singles, which he played when his mother was out. Janet called him Matthew. This was her way of separating him from family history, the whole dense endeavor of Mattiness, the little brother and abandoned son, and chessboard whiz, and whatever else was in the homemade soup. He'd told Janet the story, how Nick believed their father was taken out to the marshes and shot, and how this became the one plot, the only conspiracy that Big Brother could believe in. Nick couldn't afford to succumb to a general distrust. He had to protect his conviction about what happened to Jimmy. Jimmy's murder was isolated and pure, uncorrupted by other secret alliances and criminal acts, other suspicions. Let the culture indulge in cheap conspiracy theories, Nick had the enduring stuff of narrative, the thing that doesn't have to be filled in with speculation and hearsay. Of course, Matt thought his brother was guilty of emotional delusion. But when Janet agreed too readily, dismissing Nick's version, he cut her off quick. He defended Nick. He told her how he himself had thought their father was dead, originally, not a runaway, a dropout, the grievously weak man who takes a powder. Dead somewhere in untranslated space. And even if he was a little kid at the time, even if he did the sad, funny, fruitcake thing of going to the Lowe's paradise to see the soul of his faithful departed father drift across the starry ceiling, even if he was unable to make a studied judgment, he told her, consider the episode itself. The journey he'd made to a movie house through strange neighborhoods alone at the age of 6. The power of an event can flow from its unresolvable heart, all the cruel and elusive elements that don't add up. And it makes you do odd things, and tell stories to yourself, and build believable worlds. Who the hell was Janet to ridicule his brother? There were scar lines in the distance, deep arroyos, and stands of tall saguaro on the south slopes of mountains. The track was white sand and then red dirt. It was cracked playa, drained and baked. And then it turned abruptly to mineral green dust, and then again to sand, and finally stony rubble. Janet liked to drive aggressively, whatever the surface. The Jeep bucked and jumped, leaning badly at times. And when the track went narrow in thick bush, she had to tell him to get his dangling arm back inside before the thorny acacia cut him up. I don't think you should leave your job out of conscience. Conscience works both ways, she said. You have duties and obligations. If you're not willing to do this work, the next person may be less qualified. How hot do you think it is? Never mind how hot. Too hot to be here. You have special training and a certain kind of skill. At some point, we have to decide whether to turn around and go back out the way we came in. Or what? Or keep going into Bighorn Country and exit the refuge somewhere in the northwest sector before the exercises start. 10 minutes after he said this, they saw objects in the distance, and he put the binoculars on them. They appeared to be tanks and jeeps, some trucks as well, but they were flimsy somehow, unbulky and perfunctory, showing squared-off contours and a cheap gleam. Simulated tactical targets. I want us to be together, she said. You know how much I want a home and family. I want to have a child. I've always wanted these things. I want to be safe, Matthew. He reached over and fingered some loose hair at the nape of her neck. You want to be safe. This is the woman who works half the night treating injured people, he said. Shocks to the body, one emergency after another. There's nothing unsafe about that. That's completely safe to me. It's the thing I do best, and I want to keep on doing it. And you should do the thing you do best. That's what safe is. If I keep this job, how do we live together? We'll do it. We'll work it out, she said. The air went taut, and the light took a chlorine edge, and then it was raining hard. They couldn't see a thing, and sat parked on a rise. The storm seemed to originate 10 feet above them. They sat there waiting, and they talked. Matt could tell her anything. It was completely easy with her. She knew him before he was born. She could finish a thought he'd only barely started. She had no shaded spaces in her, none of the silences and disguises that can be fascinating, yes, but not for a guy like him, he thought. They heard name-saying birds, such as whippoorwills and phoebes. After the rain, the heat came blowing back, and he scanned with the glasses for birds of prey. They hung in the burning air, fantailed and soaring and great. And he went scrambling for the book when he spotted a large dark bird nested in the arm crotch of a tall saguaro. It was a golden eagle, immature. And he gave Janet the binoculars and took them back and couldn't stop talking. He talked and laughed and looked at the books. He talked less to Janet than to the bird. He checked the book a number of times to confirm for the bird's benefit that it was an eagle, an eaglet, with a bit of flashing on the wings and a wash of honey gold at the hind neck. Janet wasn't caught up in this. He glanced at her and found a complex plea in her eyes. She was asking him something, but he wasn't sure what it was. He put the glasses back on the bird. The bird was a flick of the dial to her. You turned on the TV in the nurse's lounge and saw giraffe heads bobbing on the veldt. This was her nature preserve, a cramped room with a couple of sofas and chairs where she sat and yacked with the night staff about coffee prices and unsafe streets and the burn victim with the smell you can't describe. This was the hand grip, the safe hold she needed to live. But the look she'd given him was not about what she needed or where she preferred to be. She wanted him to understand something about himself. Every defeat was a death inside the chest, his little bird-boned thorax. Basically dead at 11, that was him. Good riddance to little wooden rooks. How many years did it take him to get over the game? It was Fisher Spassky that brought him back, and only briefly at that, 2 years ago, in Iceland, halfway between Washington and Moscow, where they played 21 games, Bobby and Boris, a summer's rousing theater of black and white. Matt checked the newspapers and watched TV. He rooted for Bobby, the gangly, boorish boy now pushing 30. He identified with the public tantrums, all the rude demands, the strokes of unwholesomeness that Bobby consistently delivered, the open show of bitterness when he lost. If the Americans' eventual victory didn't begin to redeem Matt's own sulky youth, at least it edged the game out of the private migraine of abnormal introversion and into the mingled thing out there, the everyday melee of competing states and material forces. You need a makeshift word to describe the progress. De-egoed. This is what the game did to Matt. So let our Bobby rant. He was only showing what is always there beneath the spatial aesthetics and the mind-modeling rigor of the game, beneath the four visional bursts of insight, an auto-world of pain and loss. He told her about mountains hollowed out in New Mexico. These were storage sites for nuclear weapons. He told her about the gouged mountain in Colorado where huge wall screens could display the flight track of a missile launched from a base in Siberia. He knew a few things about Objekt, the installation built by slave labor in a remote part of the USSR, and he told her about it, a center for bomb design. People went willingly to these places, scientists eager to meet some elemental need. Or was it just a patriotic duty? Or the standard challenge of doing serious work in physics or mathematics? He thought they went in search, on impulse, almost recklessly, to locate some higher condition. "You make it sound like God," she said. He told her what he could about the pocket. The pocket was just a cozy donut dunk in a vast hidden system, a system predicated on death from the sky. He told her about the emergency network's underground shelters carved out of mountains in Virginia and Maryland, where leaders could keep the government running during a major war. He told her about accidents in the Soviet Union, rumored explosions and fires at nuclear plants, and the sense of excitement he felt, the thrill of devastation in the enemy barrens, and his subsequent shame. "You make it sound like God, or some starker variation thereof. Go to the desert or tundra and wait for the visionary flash of light, the critical mass that will call down the Hindu heavens, Kali and Shiva and all the grimacing lesser gods." "Maybe I stayed a Catholic too long. Should have got out when I was 10. He thought about the sensitives preparing for psychic war. And he thought about the penitentes, men in black hoods dragging heavy wooden crosses through the desert 100 years ago, or 50 years, and lashing themselves with sisal and hemp, all that Sister Edgarish stuff, and speaking fabricated words, the maunder of roaming holy men. "I don't know what you mean by staying a Catholic. I told you what I think about conscience," she said. "It's only partly that.
It's mainly that I feel I'm part of something unreal. When you hallucinate, the point of any hallucination is that you have a false perception that you think is real. This is just the opposite. This is real. The work, the weapons, the missiles rising out of alfalfa fields, all of it. But it strikes me more and more as sheer distortion. It's a dream someone's dreaming that has me in it. Maybe Janet was a little annoyed by this, found it self-indulgent or unconvincing, or beside the point. "I heard a story not long ago," he said. "They did a bomb test in the 1950s, in which 100 pigs were dressed in custom-made GI field jackets and positioned at well-spaced intervals from the blast site. 111, to be exact, pigs, as the story was told to me. Then they exploded the device. Then they examined the uniforms on the barbecued pigs to evaluate the thermal qualities of the material, because this was the point of the test." Janet didn't respond, because whatever the point of the test, and whatever the point of the story, it was only making her mad. Picture it. Chester Whites, a breed of large fat hog with drooping ears, wearing khaki uniforms with zippers, seams, everything, and with drawstrings drawn, because that's how the regulation reads. And a voice on the loudspeakers going, 10, 9, 8, 7... She told him to get his arm inside the jeep. "Is this when history turned to fiction?" he said. She looked at him briefly. "That's not the question you're asking," she said. "What am I asking?" "I don't think you're asking that question. That's a large question. And I think you're asking a smaller question, and it has nothing to do with pigs in uniforms. You're talking about something else completely." He didn't look at her. "What am I talking about, Janet?" "You tell me," she said. He kept his eyes on the rutted track and didn't say a word. Acacia slapped and twanged on the windshield and doors. They both watched the track. There was a structure about 200 yards ahead, concrete and bunker-like. Sand-streaked, with slit windows and brambly growth edging up the walls. It was nearly sundown, and they decided to camp nearby. There was something irresistible about the building, of course. Even an unyielding ruin such as this, slabbed, private, and tight. It stood alone here, with mountains behind it, and carried the tilted lyric of a misplaced object, like some prairie drive-in shut down for years with the audio hookups all askew and the huge screen facing blankly toward a cornfield. It's the kind of human junk that deepens the landscape, makes it sadder and lonelier, and places a vague, sad, subjective regret at the edge of your response. Not regret so much as a sense of time's own aesthetic. How strange and still and beautiful a chunk of concrete can be. Lived in fleetingly and abandoned, the soul of wilderness signed by men and women passing through. "I'd rather sleep in there," Janet said, "than do the tent again." There were two slab doors sealed tight, and the windows were narrow and high, but they went around the back and found an opening at waist height and climbed inside. After all the choppy hours they'd put in, jeep weaving over rubble, stone, and sand, the place seemed homey enough. A table, a few chairs, some nude calendars on the wall, and a couple of shelves filled with canned food, utensils, safety matches, and old magazines. Matt thought the bunker might have been constructed to accommodate spotters during exercises. A couple of ordnance guys helicoptered in to check firing accuracy, retrieve tow targets, and possibly mark the location of unexploded rockets and bombs. Back outside, he started a charcoal fire, and they ate quickly and unconversationally, and scraped the makings and remains into a plastic bag and stowed it in the jeep, because they didn't know what else to do with it. They carried their camp bags into the bunker and undressed in the moonlight.
Janet sat on the nylon shell, one leg flat, one flexed, and she leaned back like a sunbather at lunch break on the library steps. He approached and lowered himself and felt the sun on her body. The residue of deep heat transferred to his hands and mouth, and the way their bodies exchanged a sense of the day and the land, all the heat and blowing dust heavy on their breath, tasted again, fingertipped and felt and smelled. But the act was melancholy and slightly odd. It was calm and sweet and loving, but also odd and slightly resigned. And they lay together without speaking for a long time afterward. I think we ought to turn back in the morning.
Why?
She said. We came this far. I think we've seen everything there is to see, pretty much. You haven't seen the bighorns? I don't need to see the bighorns. I don't need to see the pronghorns either. There are pronghorns out there, antelope.
You barely saw the eagle.
I saw the eagle.
From a distance, barely, in its nest, she said.
The eagle was great. The eagle met every expectation.
She slept. He didn't.
He finally told himself the truth, that he'd wanted her to talk him out of his job. This was the question he'd been asking all along. Aren't you going to tell me that you don't want me to do this kind of work? For your sake, and the baby we'll have, and the home we'll own someday. But Janet didn't cooperate. He understood this, finally, that he'd wanted her to think he was making a sacrifice, leaving the pocket for wife and child. He'd wanted her to say, "Come to Boston and marry me." But Janet didn't say it. He wasn't made for this kind of work. He wanted to leave the job, but he didn't want to do it himself. He wanted her to do it for him. But Janet didn't do it. And she knew all along what was in his heart. And she had no patience with his arias of the unreal. Whatever we're doing in secret, she'd say, they're doing something worse. The wind drove out of the east from time to time, and he heard an animal near the jeep going for the garbage. No. He was not a weaponeer. But that wasn't the point. He'd wanted her to feel responsible and guilty for making him change his life. What an edge that would give him in the years to come.
This ends Disc 15.